You're listening to WWBC Cocoa, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere on God's magnificent planet.
That's right. If you go to 1510wwbc.com, you can hear us on any one of your listening devices by hitting that Listen Now button. And then, of course, they archive all of the shows for us there under On Demand. You press the On Demand button and just look for every Monday. Of course, it's just by date there. We share it all on our social media. It's all downloadable from our social media and our website, which is SitaMediaInc.com.
Thank you. So for our listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends for the first time, we give everyone a platform on our show right here. And, of course, the city of Cocoa recognized that and gave us a proclamation last Tuesday for being on air for 15 years on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And I reminded the good folks at the Cocoa City Council that our show, we talk about what's called kitchen table topics. We talk about healthcare. We talk about elderly exploitation. We talk about the natural environment. We talk about writing a book, reading a book, financial literacy, voting, why it's important to vote. We speak about environmental issues. Anything that someone wants to talk about, we give them a platform to become an advocate. Maybe you want to just talk about immigration reform, or sometimes people want to come on and they just want to talk about opening a nonprofit. Singers, actors, dancers, whatever it is, we give you a platform, and we all know that freedom of speech comes with a responsibility. Today is no different. We've got quite a lineup today, Miss Ellen. We've got our first segment is with a physician who's called in before from the great state of California, which I was in California last weekend. Dr. Alka Kanaya is going to be talking about heart health, especially in the South Asian humans. And, you know, I just finished Diwali, so I watched the documentary, The Brown Heart. I could swear they were talking to me and all the sweets I eat and all the refined sugars. We're going to talk to her first. She's on the phone. And then we've got a special guest in studio. Miss Jane Higgins is here, and she's going to join us to talk about she's a co-chair of the Landscaping with Florida Natives Plant Tour, and it's sponsored by the Conradina. Wow. Chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society. We're going to give her like 10 minutes at the end of this segment to talk about an event that's happening on November 9th, 2025, and then she'll tell us how to order tickets and all that. And then our last segment would be with a coach who's calling in from the UK. Her name is Nosheen, and she is going to be calling in to speak. I mean, she's coached people on Google and all the major companies all over the world, Nosheen Chen. And of course, today looks like it's a South Asian day. Except Miss Jane here is blonde. So,
by proxy.
Right. So let's talk to our Dr. Kanaya. She's a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. And she's an expert on type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease prevention. And she's focused on so much research with Asian Americans. And I want to hear more about the masala stuff. And it's not like what you put in food. It's like something she talks about.
Okay.
Anyway, so doctor, take it away. Talk to us a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on again, Sita. I think it's been a couple of years. So my team and I have been working on the masala study for the last 15 years. We've been following over 2,000 South Asian Americans. And by that, I mean people whose origins are from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. And so we have more than 2,300 participants in this study where they live in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I am, or Chicago area, or New York City area. And we've been following these people to understand what are the reasons that South Asians all over the world seem to have heart disease about 2 to 4 times higher rates than other humans. And we don't understand why. And that's the whole goal of the study, is to really do a deep dive to understand, is it genetic factors? Is it other behavioral factors? Is it a combination of both that is causing this really high rate of heart disease? And it's early heart disease. People get heart disease usually in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, but in South Asian individuals, it seems to happen 10 years earlier, and it tends to be a lot more aggressive in that it involves many more arteries of the heart and can lead to a lot of, you know, bad consequences like early death or heart failure.
Right.
So that's...
Yeah, and you know, the South Asian culture is one of joy. People want to watch the birth of their children, then they want to see their kids get married, and then, you know, then we know Mr. Death or Mrs. Death comes at the end. But a lot of people would prefer longevity instead of, like, I watched the video, and I did read about so many people that had heart attacks during the dancing garba and young people, like you say. So what I like about your study, doctor, is that you are focusing on prevention more than anything else.
Yes, it's all about prevention. It's all about preventing heart disease by preventing many of the risk factors that lead to heart disease. And the biggest risk factor is diabetes. And then the second really big one is high blood pressure. And so there's so many things in our control that we can do in terms of what we eat, what, how we exercise, what, how our, the stress levels are in our life, how we sleep, the people who we have around us and our social interactions. These are all really important in for our health, and we've known that forever. But for South Asians, there may be somewhat of a genetic predisposition to getting, you know, diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure. But when we have a healthy environment and healthy behaviors, we can mitigate that risk. That means we can drop our risk down to, you know, what everybody has. And so that's the purpose, is really finding things that are, that still bring joy in terms of the culture, the food, the dance, the family, the environment that people live in, but also are, you know, healthier in preventing heart disease.
Yeah. And so you decided, I mean, there are so many different parts of medicine and different tracks you could have taken, but you decided that heart disease was it for you. So why heart disease versus like so many other different specialties, right?
Right. And so I'm a general practice doctor. I'm a primary care doctor. I see, you know, patients from age 18 to 104 is my oldest patient. But I think, you know, having lived with parents and grandparents who had a lot of heart disease, knowing how important this is for my own community, my family, you know, people around me, seeing people have heart attacks at the age of 40 and 45 and die early deaths, you know, very young, this was a real problem. And no one really understands why. There aren't big long-term studies in South Asians. So I purposely wanted to, you know, answer this question because it is important. And, you know, South Asians make up about 23% of the world's population. So it's not a small number of people that this type of study is important for. It's relevant from people who, you know, have South Asian origins, but maybe born and living in the U.S. or Canada or, you know, the Caribbean islands. So I think it's really important that we understand why, so that we can start to, you know, mitigate or prevent these problems. And that's why I went into more of a research career. I am a professor and I do research 80% of the time and I see patients 20% of the time, because I really need to devote my energy to, you know, writing the grants and the papers and moving this line of work forward, and having a whole team at many different places around the U.S. to help work with me to answer this question.
Yeah. And, you know, you made me think of my mom. She would say, you are who you hang out with, your environment. Yeah. Like, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are, right? And you're so right, because I noticed that, you know, if you hang around with people who like to exercise, then you want to exercise. If you hang around with people who like plants, then you like plants. Yeah. If you hang around with people who like to, you know, eat a lot of food, and then they'll encourage you to eat a lot of food too. So, I mean, dancing, I love to dance. And so I think you hit the nail on the head. Were you able to pinpoint through your study why there is so much heart disease with the South Asian community?
Yeah, so we've gotten some clues to get us closer. I mean, there's no one single, you know, magic answer. It's a very complicated combination of risk factors. So as I said, there are some genetic, you know, predisposition to developing heart disease. But then there's a combination of things that, you know, our cultural ways that we eat, or the types of food that we have grown up to enjoy, can be higher in carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates like sugar and other starchy foods like rice, white rice, and potatoes, and then also high in saturated fat, so butter or clarified butter or coconut oil. You know, these are high in fats, and so we, in our cultural ways of eating, and that doesn't, you know, it depends on what parts of South Asian subcontinent you come from, because diet really varies region to region. There isn't one South Asian diet. There's 50 different types of diets, right? But, you know, if you are around a lot of other South Asian people and you're doing a lot of celebrations, a lot of festivities, you tend to eat the foods from your culture. And if you're doing that more and more often, you end up eating these celebration foods every week or every weekend when you get together. And that might be too high a dose of getting some of these, you know, really rich foods. And so I think, you know, the more we learn about diet and also other components of like exercise, as you said, there's a social contagion in like how people behave, and who you hang around with may, you know, influence your own behaviors, right? The way you eat, the way you exercise, the things you do in your life, and how sedentary you are, you know, how late you sleep, how much you drink, how much you smoke. These are all, you know, behaviors that are socially contagious. And so we are finding that South Asians tend to put body fat in not healthy places. So instead of putting extra fat stores, if you overeat, say, you know, storing fat under your skin, subcutaneous fat, is a healthy way to store fat. But unfortunately, for whatever genetic reason, South Asians tend to put fat not necessarily under the skin as much, but in the liver and around the belly. So you'll see kind of more of an apple-shaped body type for South Asian men and women. And you'll see more fat around those organs or in the muscle. And we've looked at that directly in our study with CT scans to image, you know, different parts of the body. And you can see there's a lot more fat in places it shouldn't be. And that fat can end up being, you know, really toxic in terms of causing diabetes as well as heart disease.
Well, so Jane here in the studio just opened her eyes and went, wow. Yeah. So that's interesting. So we store it around the organs, not under the skin.
Yeah, not as much under the skin. It unfortunately, you know, goes right into the liver. It goes right around the heart. It goes right around the intestines, called visceral fat. And a lot of, you know, cultures do this, but South Asians seem to do it a lot more dramatically. So you may see a person who weighs, you know, not very much. If you use like the measure of BMI that we're all used to, you know, having measured when we go to the doctor's office, the body mass index, which is your weight divided by your height, the weight may actually not be too high and the height may not be too tall. But so a South Asian may have very normal looking, you know, BMI and weight. 120 pounds, 140 pounds, 150 pounds for a man. But it's the fat is in the wrong places.
I see that in the gym all the time. I see a couple of guys that South, like Indians. I'm not sure if they're from India or the Caribbean or where else. So, and they're very short. They don't weigh a lot, but they got a big belly.
That's what it is. So you store the fat in the wrong places, which sets you up for diabetes, for number one, and then heart disease as a result of the diabetes. So if we can avoid getting that extra fat into these bad places, then that's where the magic is. And so that's where behaviors come in, because you can do things to overcome, you know, any kind of genetic predisposition. But that means you have to be really mindful about those excess calories and the types of food you're eating, the quality of the food, that you don't eat a lot of excess saturated fat or lots of carbohydrates, and you get a more balanced diet with more protein. And that doesn't have to be all meat-based. You can do a lot of plant-based proteins, nuts, you know, lots of great ways to get protein from a vegetarian diet. Because we have found that, at least from India, you know, 30 to 40% of people are completely vegetarian. Yet they have really, really high rates of heart disease and diabetes, even though they have a vegetarian diet.
So because they're frying a lot of the foods.
Frying, and then the saturated fats, and then, you know, the high carbohydrates. So, you know, the typical diet recommendation is about 50% carbohydrates, but not refined. You want to have complex carbohydrates with a lot of fiber. So that's vegetables, fruits. You don't overcook your vegetables, and you have a variety of different, you know, colors of foods that you eat. And then it's, you know, 20% should be protein. And then another 30% or so with fats, but hopefully more on the monounsaturated fats, moving to more of, you know, like the, you know, some vegetable oils or oils that come from olives, right? And avocado oils. These oils are healthier choices of oils rather than, you know, having a lot of butter or fatty saturated oils like coconut oil. So, you know, moving away from things that are unhealthy to healthy is what we're learning, is what's going to make the big difference.
Thank you. So for listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with Dr. Alka Kaneya, and she's a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. And we're talking about hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, about her research with the Asian American community. So doctor, talk to our listeners and tell us, how can people know if they're at high risk for diabetes, cardiovascular disease such as hypertension? And a lot of physicians speak about medication after the fact, or the patients themselves, they change their lifestyles after a heart attack, after a stent, not before. So help our listeners who are, you know, Asians or anybody else, like, how would they know if they're high risk?
Yeah, and that speaks to being, you know, mindful and being interested in investing in your health early and seeing your primary care physician or provider, making sure that you're getting tested annually for glucose levels in your blood, getting your cholesterol checked every year after, you know, a certain age, at least after the age of 35 or 40. And, you know, everyone should have one specific lipid factor that's relatively new is called lipoprotein little a, and that's a genetically inherited lipoprotein that seems to be runs really high in people from South Asian backgrounds. So have that checked with your doctor, have your blood pressure checked, have your weight checked, and have your waist circumference checked. Is your waist circumference, you know, half that of your height, that measure of your waist being half the size of your height or larger, that puts you at very high risk. That means that you have an apple-shaped body. And so start getting active in your health by knowing your risk factors, seeing your physician, and then making healthy lifestyle changes. And it comes down to your, you know, what you eat, what you do, how you manage your stress, and being able to, you know, choose to help these risk factors improve. If you need to be on medication, you absolutely should be on medication to prevent diseases.
Yeah. And I as I watched the film, and we only have like 4 minutes left of the segment, I noticed that they talked a lot about stress, lack of exercise, social media, developing great habits, And those are things that so many young people today are not doing. So really quick, I mean, we all talk about how our body is a temple and we want to take ownership of our body, which is we are the only ones who can do that. Nobody else can do it. But really quick, with the last few minutes, if you could talk to us a little bit, how these diseases can be prevented. And if we truly love our body and it's our temple, how can we help our temple to thrive?
Yeah. So I would recommend that people interested in this topic about South Asian health check out our docudrama, which is streaming on YouTube. Just you can Google thebrownheart.com. It's called The Brown Heart Documentary. It's 2 hours. And there are so many good behavior change, motivational tips. The last half hour is all about, like, how do you change behavior? Because it's easy for me to come and say, don't eat that, do more exercise. But how do you make the change? Because everybody knows what they should be doing. People know when they're eating food that's not good for them. There's enough, you know, public health messaging about that. But it's about taking that first step, saying, okay, that's it. Starting today, I'm going to be walking 20 minutes a day. And then the next, you layer on a second thing, like, okay, I'm going to be cutting out eating this type of food because I know that it's not good for me. Or in the third step. And so it's, and it's about getting people around you to also start, you know, adopting changes. So you have the social inputs from people saying, hey, did you get to the gym today? Hey, why don't we go together? You know, finding that these things, you know, again, you can make the changes that impact others in your own social circle.
So are you saying that I can't eat chicken tikka masala, but like maybe once a month? Because I told my husband recently, I said, you know, when I go to Taste of India and I bring half of it home, it's sort of like an anti-depression medication. It's like anti-anxiety. It's like a happy food. And he's like, yeah, I noticed like you could almost eat the container. I said, well, you have no idea how good this thing tastes with some pepper. And he says, oh, I know. I see you all the time.
So I would say find out how they cook that. And you can make it at home and you can make it in a healthier way using yogurt
rather than using cream. It's masala study, not marsala study.
Yes.
So it's not about being perfect. It's about moderation.
Yeah, but why? I mean, really quick, why did our culture teach us about rice? Because now we all fell in love with dal and rice and something. You know, and all of a sudden now, you know, it's like, okay, don't eat the rice. But we grew up on the rice.
Yeah. Well, rice, the thing is, we grew up, our ancestors weren't eating white polished rice. They were eating a more fiberful rice because they didn't have all the equipment to do the polishing that we do now. So we're getting rid of all of the fiber. And so then you eat rice and it's more like giving you a big shock of sugar and your blood glucose levels climb, right? If we eat more of the rice that's not polished, it's still got the fiber. I'm not saying eat brown rice, but, you know, the closer it gets to brown rice, the less of a problem it is because you don't get those big changes in your blood sugar levels.
Well, I'm sure we're going to get all these great tips on the brown. What's the documentary again? The Brown Heart?
Yeah.
The Brown Heart.
The Brown Heart. We will make sure we share all of that information, and we definitely need to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. And for all of our guests that are listening, we'll share all of this information on our social media as well as our website to make sure that everybody gets tuned in. And thank you so much, Doctor, for calling in and taking your time out from California to share this with us. And good luck with the study. And we hope to see better, more and more information and education to help all of us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
So just like with health, right? When you're choosing what you have to eat and choosing what, also we've always talked about our environment, right? Too. And that's what I love about the way that you have this lined up today, Sita, with the show is all about what we put in our bodies, but now about our surroundings and our environment with Jane.
What we breathe, right?
Right.
And if something is beautiful, when we wake up, while we have a cup of coffee, we will enjoy great landscaping. So for listeners who are tuning in, our friend Jane is here, and Jane reached out to me a little while ago to see if she could come on the show and speak about an event that's happening right here in town on Sunday, November 9th, and I'm going to have her talk to us a little bit. She's the co-chair of the Landscaping with Florida Natives Plants Tour, sponsored right here, and so ahead, Go ahead, talk to us a little bit about the Native Plant Society and how you got involved with plants.
Okay. Well, the name of our local chapter is the Conradina chapter. Conradina is a little native flower here that most people haven't seen, but that's what Conradina means. I got involved in the Native Plant chapter because my son was going to college, and I realized I was going to have to learn how to use a lawnmower. And I did not want to do that. I knew there had to be a better way, and I was very good at killing plants, but they were the plants from stores that were not native, and that's why they were dying. So I started going to the chapter meetings, which are very informational, educational, and the tour is an awesome way to learn about native plants because you'll see homes with mature landscapes. What is that little 4-inch pot that you bought going to grow up and look like in 5 to 10 years? That's the kind of home you'll see on the tour. Plus, everyone that comes on the tour gets a free plant, and there's also a 20% off discount that day at Native Butterfly Flowers, which is an awesome native landscape nursery that we have right here in Brevard County.
And where is it located at?
Native Butterfly Flowers is located on Irwin Avenue, right off of 192, south of 192. It's, you turn down that street, is that's right by Crunch Gym.
Yep.
I know right where that is. Yep. Yep.
I'm not sure where it is, but...
Right there, yeah. Well, you'll know, right there on 192. It's right by Dairy.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Right
that's
next to
easy
West,
location.
West Marine. Yep.
Right. So when and where is the landscaping tour?
So it's going to be on November 9th, this Sunday, 9 to 4. This year, the homes that are featured are going to be in Palm Bay and South Melbourne. One of the locations is the Founders Museum in South Melbourne that showcases the history of three African-American families that actually founded this area. It was originally named Crane Creek.
Oh, yes.
Which I didn't even know this.
Yeah, we've had them. The lady who's making the film, Dr. Terry Jones, was on the show talking about the film.
Right. Well, they have a gorgeous native landscape of all the plants that were actually here back when they were originally here. So, and the museum will be open that day for people to go into. And then you wind your way down to Palm Bay, and there's 6 homes down there along with the free plant giveaway location.
So a lot of free things are happening with the tour this year.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, and we're also, thanks for reminding me of that, we're also having artists on the tour for the first time this year that will be displaying their artwork at the tour sites. Gorgeous artwork of, you think of highwayman-type paintings, native plants, native animals, a lot of hummingbird paintings, spoonbill paintings. That should really add to the nature that you're going to see at the sites.
Right. And you know, a lot of people, they hear about events happening in town. And, you know, we have the Strawberry Festival. We have blueberries. We have all kind of stuff going on at Wickham Park, Renaissance Fair, all these things. Talk to our listeners, Jane, as to why should people be interested in this particular event and this tour?
Right. Thank you. That's a great question. Because native plants are so important to our environment for two reasons. One is for wildlife, because there are most of our local wildlife can only eat native plants. So, for instance, Dr. Tallamy, who is a famous entomologist from Delaware, has shown that native birds can only eat caterpillars. Caterpillars can only eat native plants. So if you're growing anything in your yard that isn't native, although bugs might be eating it, that's not helping the cycle of life. The other big reason to be interested in native plants is for water. Because the water we have here is so important at the Indian River Lagoon. If you have a grass lawn, generally only about 1 inch of water is absorbed by that grass. After 1 inch, everything else is running off into the Indian River Lagoon. Native plants will hold the water, and they will percolate it down to the aquifer. And as you know, the aquifer is where we get all our drinking water. So that keeps it from running off to the Indian River Lagoon and carrying pollutants with it. The other cool thing about native plants I just learned is that trees are so important, especially native trees. A native oak tree will store 10,000 gallons of water. That, again, is keeping it from running into the Indian River Lagoon and carrying pollutants with it.
That's a benefit, great benefit.
Right, so anything we can do.
So really quick story, after a hurricane, I lost one of my oak trees that was very close to my house. And unfortunately, I had to cut it down. Oh. And the oak tree roots actually were pulling the water away and storing the water in there. So when that tree went away, the foundation of my house cracked.
Oh, my goodness.
As a result of losing that tree. And I was like, see, karma was getting me. I should have figured out how to save that tree instead of cutting it down. But those types of things people don't take into consideration, because those native trees and those native plants do an excellent job of making sure that you're not just your landscaping, but that your foundation of your area stays.
Right.
So, you know, I think about sinkholes. And I think about stuff like that when I think about those things. Like that maybe those are spots that we pulled things out of that we shouldn't have been pulling out.
Right.
Right?
Right. Plus native plants, and especially big trees like that, are providing carbon sequestration. They're providing shade. And it's proven that they have a mental health benefit. If you can get out in nature and be in nature, your stress level is going to come down. When we have concrete jungles, we are more stressed out, right? So we need these trees. We need those. Dr. Tellamy would say the oak tree is the premier plant if you can't plant anything else, because it supports over 500 species of caterpillars. Not everybody has room for a big oak tree, but the more natives you can plant that are all categorized by the number of species they support on several websites like Audubon, FNPS, and the National Wildlife Federation. So you can plant your yard specifically addressing how can I get the most birds and the most caterpillars and the most wildlife in my yard. And that's what Homes on the Tour have done.
Right. And any of these native plants edible?
Oh, yes, they are. Yeah. Quite a few of them
are. So people can get the best of both worlds when they have the plants, because they can beautify their yards, attract the beautiful bees and butterflies and whatever, and they can eat.
Right, right. Plus the pollinators from the native plants will help non-natives. We all know we have to eat. So they're going to help the bananas, the mangoes, all the foods that we really like to grow by helping pollinate them right here locally.
Yeah. Why do you think there's so many people that either they're not educated on native plants, they don't want to be educated on it, some just don't care? Because it doesn't matter if you have, you know, an acre of land or half an acre or a tiny little place, as long as you could put a big pot and you could put some dirt in there and you could plant something, anybody could do this.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that there's such a pushback that some people just don't care?
Well, you know, it's almost like your prior speaker. It's what we've been taught. So we've been taught way back from feudal England that had the big grass fields, that grass was basically a symbol of success. And so that came to America. And then sure enough, here in America, we have many, many lawns and lawnmowers and grass blowers and the whole industry that is a big chunk of pollution.
What is it called? Well-manicured lawns,
right? And so people don't want to give up that lawn. But I do believe there is a movement, probably mostly starting with younger people, who are questioning, why are we doing this to our planet? Grass is adding nothing. So as more people question that, and especially locally here with the health of the Indian River Lagoon, we really have more of a sensitive issue right here with the lagoon. We've seen the lagoon go through really bad times, and it's starting to come around again.
Yeah. And you know what? A lot of us, we who care about the Indian River Lagoon, we know what it does for the fishing industry,
right?
Tourism, and all these things. And we understand this. But you still have a lot of people that, even in politicians, when they're running for office, that talk about the runoff and what's happening with the muck and all that. It always comes down to education and opportunities, right? It always does. Does the Native Plant Society, do they have like education seminars, or do they have like little groups that goes to the schools to teach our kids about food, native plants, the environment, and things like that?
That's a great question. This tour is our primary education event to the public, But we also have monthly meetings at the First Melbourne Church of the Nazarene on Babcock across from FIT. It's the second Monday of the month. You can get more information about that on our website. And we, every month, will have educational speakers come in and talk about native plants and the environment. There's also a wealth of information on the website, both Conradina chapter, fmps.org, or our website for the tour is brevardlandscapetour.org, where you can buy tickets and see all the sites that are going to be on the tour.
Well, I think our guest, Nosheen Chen, is on the phone. We'll be right with you, if you don't mind. We're finishing up our segment with Miss Jane Higgins, okay?
And I want to make sure I jump in here that there are sponsorships available for anybody that would like to sponsor the tour that is, you know, affectionate and wanting to promote the native landscaping here in Brevard County. And also that is also on the website, brevardlandscapetour.org. And you get advertising opportunities as well as top placement of, you know, of information on all of their flyers and so forth. So I want to make sure that that's out there as well, because our community is so good to us most of the time of being able to support the things that are going on right here in Brevard County.
Yeah, and I really like that this year you guys are adding on local artists to go along with the landscaping tour. So tell us really quickly, where is this happening? Give us the date, the time, and how we can buy tickets.
Okay, so again, it's Sunday, November 9th, 9 to 4. You can buy your tickets online at brevardlandscapetour.org. They're $15 for the soft copy. And when you finish purchasing your ticket, you'll be directed to the site with the tour ticket and the plant list for all the sites. You can do them in any order. If you want a printed ticket, it's $20, and you can come to Fredley Park on the day of the tour. That's Fredley Park on Emerson Road in Palm Bay. And I'll be there selling those printed tickets. But we really encourage the virtual tickets to go more paperless if at all possible.
Well, for the Florida Native Plant Society and Jane Higgins, thank you so much for coming on our show on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends and sharing so much with our world. We all talk about leaving the world a better place than we found it, and it's inherent that we bring people on our show that actually can do that and make the world a beautiful place, not just from our heart, but to look at and enjoy and breathe, because you are what you eat, sleep, and breathe, right?
Thank you. Environment.
So we're going to take a quick break, right?
Yeah, Danny, if you could run one commercial my breath, and then we're going to go right to our wonderful guest, Ms. Nosheen Chen, who is calling in. She'll tell us where she's calling in from in a minute.
Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud9, that's Cloud9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture. Located in Titusville, Florida, Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We had a wonderful first segment with Dr. Alka Kanaya. Then we had Jane Higgins. And our third segment here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, where we are heard worldwide as well as on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, and 100.7. We have a wonderful lady by the name of Noshan Shen, and she is a coach, a public speaker. She's coached leaders at Amazon, Google, startups, and she's on the phone awaiting us from France. Hello and welcome for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Hi, Sita. Thank you so much for the kind introduction. And yeah, I'm really excited. Thank you so much for reaching out and suggesting that we do this.
Well, I tell you what, sometimes we say social media causes a lot of havoc and chaos in our lives. But in this case, I found you through Instagram, and I'm grateful for Instagram. So talk to us a little bit about what you do. I mean, you've been a three-time TEDx speaker, a LinkedIn creator, a Fortune 500 public speaking coach. What else can you tell us about yourself?
Sure. Thank you for the super kind words there. I can tell you a little bit about how it started.
Yes.
If that's of interest.
Yes.
So, you know that annoying kid who gets up in front of the entire family and recites the most boring poem ever?
Yes.
So I used to be that annoying kid. Ever since I can remember, I've loved to entertain, to speak to audiences. And it does go back to my childhood because I was the youngest by far in the family. So my opinion never mattered unless I was on stage. And being on stage, being in the spotlight was the one time when I would actually get attention, when what I said actually seemed to matter. So that is something that I fell in love with very early on in life. Did not pursue it as a career. I was actually at Procter & Gamble for many, many years doing marketing and PR. Became one of the youngest communication skills trainers there. At one point, I was training people twice my age on presentation skills and communication skills. Still didn't realize that that was my calling in life. Then I was a filmmaker, a commercial filmmaker for many years. And that's when I realized that when you put people who are very accomplished in their lives and their careers, people like CEOs of startups that have raised millions of dollars, you put them in front of a camera and they become these pale robotic versions of themselves.
Because they speak from the heart. Because I think people who, it's in their heart and they're just waiting for a platform to get it out. Like you did as a child. They probably thought, oh God, here she goes again. But you had something to say, and I'm so glad you shared that with us, because there's so many people that have a burning desire to do something, and because others tell them something and it's negative, they don't do it.
That's true. That's true. A lot of people hesitate. A lot of my clients who want to work with me, they come to me and they say, Noshin, I'm saying no to these speaking opportunities because I don't feel ready. I don't feel like I'm going to impress. I don't feel like what I'm going to say will do justice to my experience. So when I was actually directing these CEOs to speak on camera, that's when I realized that even when you have the right message, you have the right expertise, sometimes when you deliver that message, if the impact is missing, if you're not really delivering it with clarity, with confidence, with the right kind of tools that can really enhance that message, then you're really leaving a lot at the table. You're not doing justice to the way that you've cultivated your experience over the years.
Yes. And it sounds to me like you are like a decision maker. When did you make the decision to become a leadership communication coach?
A funny story. So I was a filmmaker for many years, like I was telling you, but I wasn't very happy. I never felt like I was one of those visionary directors who had a vision and had to make sure it came to life. I actually really loved working with my on-screen talent. So one day I was complaining to my husband and saying that, wow, I just don't feel happy doing this. And he said, you know, the one thing that I've seen you do consistently, that you've consistently been happy doing, is speaking on stages. Why don't you figure out a way to make a career out of that? And my first response to him was, what do you mean? Who's gonna pay me to speak on stage? Who's gonna be interested in the expertise that I've gathered? Because it was a passion for me, right? So I'd just been speaking on stages, on any stage I could find, for 17 years, including TEDx. But I didn't have any faith in the fact that I had this experience that other people could really benefit from. In fact, I loved speaking on stage so much that I didn't realize it was a huge fear for a lot of people. And then I started looking into it and realized that a lot of times speaking in public, doing presentations, speaking up in meetings, and of course, speaking on stages or speaking on camera, this can really be a hurdle for a lot of people. It can stand in the way of their success. So that's when I started doing coaching for public speaking. And that was about 3.5 years ago. And I haven't looked back.
Yeah. And I know people like that where they've just freeze up. Like they'll say, oh, my blood is just running cold. They can't speak. So give us a few tips to help people who've got all this knowledge and this passion and experience. But when they freeze up like that, nothing comes out of their mouth.
Yeah, the most important thing is first to understand why it's happening, because I really like getting to the root of things instead of just trying to put a Band-Aid on something. So why it happens is because we have been programmed. There's a lizard part of our brains that feels that when you are singled out, when you are in a wide open space, everyone else is looking at you, you have no weapons, nowhere to hide, and no group behind you or in front of you. When you're alone, the lizard part of your brain feels like, oh my God, that's danger. Because there was a time when that was dangerous for us. We would get hunted down, we would get killed. So there is that fight, flight, or freeze instinct that kicks in. And the best thing to do is to really take control of it. I always tell my clients that you don't realize it, but when you're on stage, you are the one in control. All you need to do is first understand that you are the one leading the room. And then, of course, work on so the limiting beliefs that you might have that are blocking you from actually being the most impactful you can be. A lot of people have a fear of failure. A lot of people have a fear of being critiqued in public. A lot of people feel that I'm just not going to be able to articulate my thoughts in the best way. But these are all limiting beliefs, and you can work on them to challenge them, turn them around. For the fear of being critiqued, for example, I always tell people the audience is not there to judge you. Unless you're on American Idol, the audience isn't going to judge you. They are just there to learn. Right. You have to just switch the way that you're thinking about it.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people that when they get on stage, there's so much going on in their brain. How do you help one to focus on one skill? Like, one, you know, you go there and you see an audience of a variety of people and you say, oh, I want to talk about this. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me like you are the kind that just speaks from your heart and you have no notes. You just talk.
Well, right now, yes, I don't have notes because we're having a wonderful conversation. Yes. But it's a really great point that you bring up. It's all about committing to the moment and being what I call 1,000% present. So because I have a filmmaking background, I often give this analogy. Imagine that you have an actor on a film set and the actor needs to deliver their best performance. However, they have the script writer who keeps running up to them, tapping them on the shoulder and saying, no, say it like this. Oh, no, I changed my mind. These are the lines. Oh, no, try this joke instead. And on the other hand, they have the director who keeps, again, calling cut. No, cut, that was awful. Cut, do it again. If you are the actor in that scenario, do you think that you would be able to deliver the best performance of your life?
Heck no.
No.
Right?
But this is essentially what we're doing to ourselves. In our brains, we play all three roles. We're the script writer, giving our mouth the words to say. We are the director who is being critical and evaluating our performance. The issue is you can't be all three at the same time. When you're on stage, when you're on camera, when you're on a wonderful radio show like this, you need to purely focus on being the actor. You need to trust the script, and the script writer needs to trust you. The director needs to trust that you're going to deliver the performance. And of course, you can review it later with the director for the next take. But when you're in the moment, if you can be 1,000% tuned in, trust that the words are going to come, your message is going to make sense. And of course, practice beforehand. understand the tools that you can acquire to deliver that message with impact, that's how you can really conquer all of those voices. It's like silencing all the other voices in your head and purely focusing on being there for the audience.
Wow. So for listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with Nosheen Chen. She's calling in from France. And we said that our show is all over the world. We're not kidding. She's a three-time TEDx speaker, a public speaking instructor for the MBA program at Central European University. And you have a LinkedIn creator with 111,000 followers? Is that what I read?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, I...
And you also coach at Amazon and Google and all that. So talk to me a little bit about leadership. Like, what is the most leadership lesson you've ever learned that you could share with our listeners here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends?
So the number one mistake that I see a lot of leaders making is that they don't think of every speaking opportunity as an opportunity to make impact. Very often you're doing team meetings. Very often you're talking to external parties about your company, about your work and your team, your product. But if you just focus on creating a beautiful slide deck, if you just focus on having a speech that you're going to read out, you're not connecting with the audience. If you don't connect with the audience, that opportunity is lost. You're not going to make an impact. People aren't going to understand and remember you. If you think back, and this is for everyone who's listening, if you think back to all the presentations that you've sat through in your life at work, there's probably tens of thousands of presentations that you've sat in or sat through. And very often you've forgotten what the presenter was, what they said, what the message was. And that's because they are simply delivering the message. They're not really working on creating an experience. And so it's that fact that really sets people apart from just being average and being forgotten to really making an impact every single time they speak.
Yeah, and I think in your case, we're looking at your photograph, you're also very beautiful. So that makes a difference when you're looking at somebody that's pretty on stage. I mean, I've been, you know, you're on TikTok sometimes and you see some things and then you see something with somebody else. And I think the way we look, the way we present ourselves, the self-confidence mm-hmm. that we have, it does make a difference when you're on stage and speaking to people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always tell people there are two sides to confidence. There's the outer side, which is the performative side. So having a confident stance, using gestures, making eye contact, all of those are performative ways of showing confidence. But then what's more important is that inner confidence, actually feeling like I am the one in control. I'm the one who's going to make sure that someone in the audience is going to walk away knowledge rich after my presentation. And so they work together hand in hand. And of course, when someone's confident, I really believe that people of all backgrounds, of all kind of expertise levels, they can rise to become amazing speakers. It's just about working on the right skill set.
Yeah. So before we let you go, I mean, I know you have a lot of workshops because you've spoken, presented, and trained at workshops for Google, Women in Tech Berlin and Hamburg, European Chamber mm-hmm. of Commerce, German Chamber of Commerce, Twitch. Well, excuse me, you're in. We're so grateful to have you on our show. The Ohio State University, marketing meetups, the Startup Grind, the TED Crunch Disrupt. Are you going to be in Florida by any chance so we could have you in our studio and maybe I can make you some curry chicken?
Oh, my God. I would love to. The last time I was in Florida, I was in Tampa, but that was about 15 years ago.
Oh, well, I'll collaborate with you. I'll collaborate with you and we'll create something beautiful. I'll create some food and I'll listen to the doctor that called in earlier and make sure it's 50% salad, 25% protein, and 25% roti or rice. But really quick, give us your website or how someone could contact you. And we really would love to have you back on our show in a few months if possible. So give us your website before we end the segment, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on speaking.coach. So hopefully that's very easy to remember, speaking.coach. And if you go there, you can also get a free course that really talks about all the tools that I've been talking to you about that goes into more detail. And you can learn how to start being impactful and powerful when you speak anywhere. So that's speaking.coach.
Well, you've empowered us just like your mission is. And thank you so much for taking the time to call in from France. And if you don't mind, I will send you a photograph of us in the studio listening to you and how wonderful it was to have you on our program.
And I'll be able to.
Thank you so much, Sita.
And I'll be able to split up the segments so that way you'll have your own segment that you can use it on any one of your social media as an MP3 download. Wow. And thank you so much for calling in. And we have all of your information from your website already to share with all of our listeners. And we have one other caller, right, Sita?
Just for a few minutes, someone is calling in quickly to speak about what's going on in New York City with Zohran Mamdani and how energized the voters are up there. And Nosheen, I'm sure I'll hear from you. And thank you so much. And we'll hang up with you because the other lady has to call in on this line. Okay, bye.
Thank you again.
All right, love. Bye-bye.
Well, how did you meet this next caller that's calling in, Sita?
Long story, TikTok.
Two words, TikTok. What a great day this has been, Sita. We've had an opportunity to talk about so many great things that are going on, not only this time, not only in our community, but certainly in our world this time for sure.
Well, I have a friend who's calling in right now. Her name is Fatima Khan, and we met on TikTok, and we both are fans of the soon-to-be mayor of New York, Zohran Mamdani. And I just wanted to have somebody who's energized and working on the campaign, volunteering, call in and share her thoughts with us. So thank you, Fatima, for taking the time to call in.
Thank you, Sita. I appreciate you having me on.
You know what? So you go by the name Paisley Diva, and we met on TikTok. So really quick.
Yes, we did.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about why you are supporting Mr. Mamdani, and what's the atmosphere like up there with your friends and family?
Well, my whole family, my whole community, the whole Muslim community in Brooklyn is behind him 100,000%. And my whole family, everyone started voting. We're all voting for him. I came here in 1963, so I'm here a very, very long time. And at that time, there was no one that looked like me in politics at all. It was all old white men, to be honest.
Yes.
And now it's so refreshing to see someone of color, a Desi person. And honestly, it doesn't matter to me whether he's Pakistani or Indian or Bengali or, you know, whatever. It's more important that someone of our ilk is representing us.
Yeah,
I feel like I'm finally being seen.
Right. And there's so much, you know, hatred and division and fear mongering and bigotry. Quickly, I tell people all the time, if you sit down with a Hindu or Muslim or Baha'i or Jew or Christian, everybody wants the same thing at the end of the day. They want to be able to live, work, pay their bills, pay taxes. And I think people should understand that. So would you say that the Islamophobia that we're seeing is just plain wrong? Because you've been here since you were 7 years old, and you are assimilated as any American.
Absolutely. It's real. The Islamophobia is unreal. They always talk about how everything is anti-Semitic. No, it's more Islamophobia than anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes. And what would you tell people, you know, like, to stop it? Because I've been saying to people, stop the hate. You know, there's no reason for that. At the end of the day, it's our inherent right to leave this planet a better place than we found it. It's our responsibility to be kind, to be nice, and to promote a kinder, gentler, more mindful world. It's not our fault that God made us brown or black or made us born into a home where someone is practicing a different faith. And you've lived in the United States so long. We have 30 seconds. Tell our listeners a little bit about why people should not fear any Muslim or anybody who is not promoting hate.
Islam is a religion of peace. If you don't understand that, then I don't know if you've been living under a rock. But Islam is always—it's always been a religion of peace. Salam alaikum means peace be upon you. And we welcome—I have friends of all races and religions: Chinese, Jewish, Greek, you name it, Italian. Those are all my friends. I grew up with all these people, so we never saw the kind of racism that I'm seeing now, the Islamophobia I'm seeing, I've never seen that in my lifetime. I just feel like the whole the MAGA crowd, they just brought out all that racism that was, you know, underneath the surface just came up. So
hopefully if we break bread together, we can show people that everyone wants the same on God's magnificent planet.